Hello and welcome to this episode of Priced Out Podcast. I'm joined by my co-host Ruben.
Hello.
And today we've got the enigmatic Zach Simons from Planorax.
Hello there.
Today we're going to be looking into why does the world need planning barristers and talking about to what extent our system is plan-led and touching on things as the Greenbelt. Don't forget to hashtag Priced Out Podcast and tweet and share on Spotify.
Zach, so thanks so much for coming on the show. Can you explain a bit about what you do, what planning barristers do? What's your day-to-day look like?
It's a good question, that one. What do we do? My time is split really between court challenges on the one hand. So it could be a judicial review challenge to the grant of a planning permission, say, or to the a challenge to the grant or refusal of an appeal by a planning inspector, that kind of thing. Court challenges on the one hand and appeals on the other. Most of my time really is spent acting for or against schemes on appeal, so appearing in support of or against schemes of all sorts, really, in front of planning inspectors, inquiries or hearings, or DCO nations, that kind of thing, examinations of local plans. So that's my day-to-day. It's really going from one planning inquiry to the next.
So talk me through the kind of legal process of planning, where planning barristers might fit in. So you mentioned judicial reviews, you mentioned appeals. Talk from a new development perspective, what process does it follow, and where are those things that you said you do in that process?
Well, I mean, what I really prefer is to get involved right at the very beginning, particularly for larger schemes where there's a sense that maybe it might end up at appeal, say if it's a little bit more controversial or tricky, and you have a sense that perhaps you're not going to be able to persuade, you know, the local planning authority of the virtues of your scheme. You know, in the end, maybe if you're looking ahead, that you're going to end up in front of a planning inspector. And so in those circumstances, given that it'll be me or another barrister who'll end up fighting that case for you down the line, it makes sense, or it can make sense, to get us involved early to sort of give a sense check to the application, whatever it might be. This is assuming, of course, that you're acting on the side of whoever it is that's promoting the scheme. And you can, you know, sense check all the documents. You can look out for you know, legal banana peels. You can review officers' reports, that kind of thing. Make sure that we aren't walking into an enormous, you know, legal trap one way or the other. And so whichever side you're on, really, at that stage, the idea is to ensure that if there's going to be a consent, it's a sound consent, a consent that will withstand legal challenge one way or the other.
So a developer applies for planning permission, and it's nice to involve a lawyer before that if possible, but if not, then not. Mm-hmm. So then that planning permission is approved or rejected. But that's something that is not, you know, the planning committee doesn't have a final arbitration on. So it's up for discussion.
That's right. It's up, very much up for discussion. So there are two options, obviously, when you apply for planning permission. You either get it or you don't get it. If you get it at the local level, then it is possible for objectors to challenge that consent in a judicial review in the High Court. And so obviously lawyers get involved at every part of that process, acting for objectors, acting for local authorities who are trying to defend the consent, and developers who are also trying to defend it. That's if you get your consent at the local level. Now, if you don't get your consent at the local level, you've got a statutory right to appeal that refusal to the planning inspectorate. And so obviously, you know, barristers get pretty heavily involved in that process, presenting all of the arguments in writing, and then also, you know, orally at planning inquiries and all the rest of it, cross-examining witnesses, that kind of thing. I mean, really, that really is my bread and butter. That's what I was doing earlier today. That's what I'm doing next week, the week after that, and the week after that, all the way through to September. At the moment, it's one after the next. But it's that kind of those sort of heavy duty appeals that really keep us busy.
So against what standards are you making your arguments? Because obviously in criminal law, you know that there are laws that you look against. What are you looking against when you're arguing in favour of a development?
Well, I mean, when it comes to a planning inquiry, whether you're arguing in favour or against it, and one thing I should say is that the cab rank rule is a really sort of foundational ethic of our profession. So unlike lots of other people in the industry, we're not, even if we wanted to, we're not entitled just to stick on one side of the fence. We're professionally obliged to take cases that, you know, we may think are great, but we might not. We might fundamentally disagree with our clients about the merits or demerits of a scheme. It's got nothing to do with it. If our clients, you know, come along and they're willing to sort of pay a fair market wage for our, in a case that's within our area of expertise, we take the case. That's the cab rank rule. So whether you're for it or against it at an appeal, what are you arguing about? I mean, in the end, what you're arguing about is Section 38(6) of the Planning and Compulsory Purchase Act 2004. So the big issues are, does the thing that you're arguing about accord with the statutory development plan, the local plan, whatever it might be? If it does, great. But either way, even if it doesn't, are there still material considerations that make it worth granting planning permission? And, you know, material considerations include all sorts of things. They include, number one, national policy. That includes the green belt, to which we will return. And number two, national policy and guidance that pertains to the housing crisis. So, you know, from 2012, when the government introduced the NPPF, National Planning Policy Framework, the courts described that as a radical shift in national policy, because for the first time, the government wasn't just saying meeting housing needs was just another thing that you had to do, along with all the other things that you have to do in a planning system. Yeah, it said that meeting housing needs is a particular priority, that, and you've got to not just aim at them, you've got to meet them, and you've got to meet objectively assessed needs for housing. So it was a big shift. And that all comes under the heading of other material considerations that might justify departures from a local development plan.
Right, I see. And that presumably would also be the case if there isn't a plan, you'd have to default to the NPPF.
If there isn't a plan, or more usually, I mean, normally there's a plan. The question is, how old's the plan? How up to date is the plan? You know, in St Albans, say, where I'm doing an appeal in a month or so, they've not had an up-to-date plan since the early 90s. You know, in York, they've not had a plan since the 1950s. You know, so normally the question is, how old's the plan? How consistent is the plan with the modern NPPF, with the revised NPPF, and the up-to-date national objectives of significantly boosting housing land supply? That's what we argue about, that an awful lot. Because, you know, old-fashioned planning policies, particularly those from the 80s and 90s, were much more restrictive when it came to the approach to be taken to new housing development. And so, yeah, a lot of it is about trying to explain to inspectors why and how central government policy indicates that we need to be a little bit more on the front foot when it comes to trying to sort of confront the housing crisis.
That's so interesting. And it's just average judges that would hear any other kind of civil cases
so not quite. In the planning court, when you're in the High Court doing judicial reviews, then yeah, we have specialist judges, although they also hear other kinds of public law case, but they're judges who ideally have some sort of background, professional background, as planning barristers before they go to the bench, ideally. But when it comes to these inquiries that I'm talking about, these appeals, we're having those arguments not in front of judges, but in front of government planning inspectors. They're civil servants. They are ex-planning consultants. Some of them are ex-solicitors, architects, who have decided to make the jump into the world of the planning inspectorate. And that's the body which is charged with determining appeals against refusals of planning permission. So it could be all sorts of people do the job. It's a very interesting job to do. It is a sort of quasi-judge-like role. And you have an awful lot of power in that role, because you do tend to have, subject to the High Court, you will have the final say on whether or not very substantial pieces of development go forward or not.
It's really interesting because talking about kind of issues of democratic accountability and NIMBYism and YIMBYism, it sounds as if actually both sides might have it a bit wrong, because NIMBYs, for example, would say that attempts in the planning white paper to take away democratic accountability is a really bad thing. YIMBYs might say there's way too much as it is. But actually, there are things that happen post the democratic process that could decide a scheme either way. What impact does NIMBYism or YIMBYism, like local objections or supportive statements to schemes, what does that play in in your role?
There's no doubt about it. You know, the impact of local people, local organisations, local, you know, groups who tend to be objecting to development, but not always, it can have a profound effect on the process, a profound effect. I think normally it's felt most acutely at the local level, so i.e. when the local planning authority is making its decision to grant or to refuse consent, because then, you know, local politics is, it can be the determinative factor, not just one of the factors, the determinative factor on whether or not consent gets granted. You like to think that the impact of local objector groups starts to recede a little when you get to the planning inspectorate level. And the only reason that I say that is because normally what the planning inspectors are more interested in is, rather than the local politics, what they're interested in are the technical arguments. You know, so they are at one remove from the heat of the local politics. They're only interested in planning considerations. They're not interested in getting re-elected. You know, they're only interested in, you know, in considerations for which there is evidence, you know, the assertions which can be proven or debated or supported with reference to technical evidence. So you know, I've been at planning inquiries where literally hundreds and hundreds of people have spoken for and against schemes. You also get local groups organising into what are called Rule 6 parties. They can be professionally represented at these planning inquiries. They can have barristers there. They can have teams of witnesses. But they can make an enormously profound impact on the process. But I think that the key difference, as I say, between the local level decision making and the planning inspectorate level is the inspectors are more interested in a sort of cold, hard analysis of the arguments rather than the sort of the local invective.
I see. So for example, people wanting a development not to go ahead could be represented at that stage, but they would have to change their tack and just their opinion. It wouldn't matter. It would be about what arguments could they make, which is probably why you have crowdfunding for things like Save the Bethnal Green Mulberry Tree to get the representation, perhaps.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. No, you're right. And when it comes to the High Court, you know, then that's not really a process that you could describe as democratic anymore, because local people don't get to go along as of right to address the High Court judge. Then it really is just the main parties who are involved in the litigation. So by that point, the local voice has rather gone out of the process.
So just on that then, Zach, if you've got there's gone through a democratic process to like allocate land through local plans when they do it, as you pointed out, haven't done it for 70 years. Then there is, there's people employed, technical experts by the council, who then will make a recommendation for approval or a recommendation to refuse. But it doesn't end there. So after the democratic process, then there's a technical check, and then it goes to the local committee, where they will then have another bite of the cherry to say yay or nay. And often, you know, some may argue that technical process is sort of can be impeded or influenced politically to find reasons to reject And then you've got this, you know, if you are rejected, even though you've been recommended for approval, then the likelihood that there'll be an appeal. So where does the judicial review come in? Is that often where there's been an approval?
Exactly. You get the JR is when there's been a grant rather than a refusal. If you get refused at committee, your route forward is to appeal to the planning inspectorate. It's only if there's been a grant that those who would seek to resist the development have the opportunity to whack in a judicial review claim to the High Court. Not to say they'll succeed, and most fail, but albeit most fail, even if you lodge a JR and you lose, you can still, and some people deliberately try to, achieve a delay that can stretch into the months or even, you know, gulp into the years. And actually that delay that's caused by unsuccessful JRs can in itself lead to schemes being ditched, which can be past the point of lodging it in the first place.
That's interesting, because what you're doing is effectively all of those costs then come out of the viability of the scheme. So these people are having a material impact on affordable housing delivery, a material impact on the level of homes that are provided. I mean, in my mind, you know, just to Ruben's point about campaign groups crowdfunding, you know, there's also councils get taken for costs, right, as a result of failed attempts. Do you see that?
Well, absolutely. You do. I mean, and particularly in circumstances where you end up with members conjuring up reasons to refuse permission against officers' recommendations, you do find yourself in circumstances where the council's conduct in resisting a scheme is what we would call unreasonable. That's the language of the government guidance, unreasonable. And if you can point to unreasonable conduct, which is, you know, refusing a scheme, pursuing a refusal without any evidence to support it, without any objective, sensible evidence to justify their position, which does happen when decisions are taken against officers' advice, then yeah, it can be a very expensive exercise for local authorities. And when you get to the High Court, the general position is that the losing party pays the other party's costs. So there too, you know, there are serious risks for all parties in going to the High Court, that you're going to end up with an adverse costs award against you. But you're right to say that we can end up with it harming the bottom line of scheme's viability. There's no doubt.
How do you feel about YIMBY counter campaigns? I mean, there's a tongue-in-cheek one. Destroy the Bethnal Green mulberry tree, all in time. We are familiar with the person who launched that campaign as a result of a Twitter storm, as Judy Dench railed against a scheme already approved by a council who'd taken things on balance over a tree that looks quite decrepit.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the rise of these YIMBY movements and campaigning against?
I think it's, so professionally, I'm not allowed to have a view about any of this stuff because we are literally professionally neutral, you know, and that's the position that we have to take, because we do end up acting for those who support and oppose development all the time. I also cannot talk about the mulberry tree example because a couple of years ago I advised on the development that's going forward at the London Chest Hospital. So I can't get into that one. But I think I am pro-engagement. And I'll tell you one thing that I can say is that I think for too long, as someone who's spent, you know, over a decade now, spending most of my time at planning inquiries and committee meetings, you do get a lot of engagement, but it has tended to be engagement on one side of the argument. And I think it's skewed. I think it's engagement from a certain age demographic, socio-political demographic, all of that. And I think that we need more balance in the discussion. I think that planning inspectors too often only get one side of an argument, to which there are many sides. And I think that the more we get people who are, sorry to say it, but slightly younger, slightly, you know, more diverse, people who might actually need the housing that's being debated rather than people who already own their own homes and are perfectly content, thank you very much, to, you know, draw the line or sort of, you know, pull up the drawbridge where things have reached. I think it's going to lead to a more balanced, more healthy conversation. And I've got to say, I feel pretty strongly about the idea that virtual planning and the way that things have been going over the last 12 months have really helped that, facilitated that effort to try and, you know, broaden the reach, try and meet people where they are, meet younger people where they are, which is, you know, on the internet, which is on social media. It's not in local council chambers, because we've not got the time, because people have jobs, because people have kids, because, you know, all of that. So I think virtual planning could actually be a really profound force for a positive change and a sort of rebalancing of the discussion, which is why I've got to say, literally today we found out that the government does not intend to introduce any sort of emergency legislation to extend the new laws that govern virtual committee meetings. So that's all going to expire on the 7th of May of this year. And we're talking now in towards the end of March of 2021, which I've got to say is that I consider to be a real shame, a serious shame, because not only are we sort of going back to the bad old days of, you know, forcing people to clamber into, you know, busy or, you know, freezing cold or boiling hot Victorian committee rooms, in a time of where we're still dealing with, you know, the impacts of national lockdown and COVID and all the rest of it. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like a very good idea to me. But even more importantly, sort of long term, I think it's really important, the gains that we've made in the last year in terms of trying to encourage sections of the community who haven't always been engaged in planning because they've got better things to do, to get involved, from their front rooms, to get involved, you know, over Zoom or Teams or whatever. And I would think that would be an enormous shame if we let that go.
I totally agree. There's some stuff in the planning white paper about virtual engagement. So hopefully when that comes through, the virtual engagement side might come around in a different form, fingers crossed. Yeah. On the kind of, I totally agree with your points, obviously, about the way planning is kind of stacked against the objectors rather than the supporters. I think as well as the kind of age demographics and other things you mentioned, another point that I think might be controversial is that new housing is not for local people. Naturally you are more likely to write in support or objection to a new development near you, whereas it's actually not necessarily those people that are the beneficiaries. And I feel like moving democracy upstream as per the planning white paper's proposals will help a lot with that, because we shouldn't expect people from all around the country to be writing in support of every single development, which is why we need a system where democratic accountability isn't at the development level, in my view anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think that where things really started to go wrong was in 2010, 2011, where Eric Pickles, when he was Secretary of State, decided to sort of devolve down the power to decide how many houses go where to local planning authorities at the local district level through the Localism Act. And that has turned out to be a bit of a disaster. And, you know, ironically, it's that disaster, really, that this planning white paper that was published in August of last year, 2020, spends a lot of its time trying to solve without actually coming out and telling us really how it's going to do it. But, you know, that's the problem. The problem is that letting local authorities, individual local authorities, try and sort of sort out their own housing requirements has led to chronic and, you know, exacerbated chronic underdelivery of housing at the national scale. Because, as you say, it's very difficult to garner political support at the local level for lots of new housing. Housing's the kind of thing that everybody supports in principle, but nobody supports in particular, i.e. where they are, you know, and that's the challenge.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with you, Zach. I mean, it has been the devolution and the devolved powers has allowed sort of fervent NIMBYism to take over and often prevent housing on a scale that far from what we need to be delivered. I think there was an interesting tweet from, I think, is it John Gleeson, Ruben? Mm-hmm. The GLA fellow, very good with the data.
James.
James, thank you. Over at in France, and they have a similar population to ours, yet their target's 500,000 and they've only built 400, and they've been, you know, saying how much of a disaster that is. And when you actually look at from the economics perspective over here, if you're just going on basic terms, if we were to grow our housing stock at a rate faster than incomes are growing, all things being equal, if your stock's growing slower than your incomes, then prices are going to go up. And in London over the last 10 years, incomes have grown double the rate that new housing stock has, and we're just nowhere near targeting enough. But I suppose the thing what we want to come on to next really is to what extent it touches on this Eric Pickle situation. You know, is our system really plan led? You said before, you touched on there that, you know, perhaps the local planning authorities didn't have that power before, but is our system really plan led? You've touched on this.
Well, the first question is, what does plan led actually mean? So, yes, in theory, you know, you start with the plan, right? Okay. I mean, you know, that sounds like quite an uncontroversial thing to say. And the law reflects that kind of presumption. The law, which is now in section 38.6, says that, you know, we look first to the development plan. Okay. But we don't stop there. That's the key. The term plan-led gets bandied around, and I think probably misunderstood, because yes, we start with the plan, but the law, the legal system for planning in this country does not expect that the plan will have anticipated every single, you know, eventuality into the future, nor does it anticipate that every plan's going to be absolutely bang up to date every single time you put in an application for planning consent. There might be good reasons for taking a decision that doesn't accord with the plan. And if you do that, it's completely consistent with the plan-led system. Because the plan-led system says you look to the plan, but you also look, as I said earlier, to other material considerations, prime amongst them, national policy, the MPPF, the need to significantly boost housing land supply. So is the system genuinely plan-led? Yeah, it is. But the problem is when plans fall back, when plans fall behind, when they don't keep up with the times or don't reflect what's going on in national policy, which has happened, obviously, in a very acute way in lots of authorities, particularly Greenbelt authorities in the last few years, then we need to keep, you know, the needs don't evaporate just because the plans aren't being refreshed. The needs exacerbate and we need to meet them, which means that the plan-led system can produce outcomes which are not anticipated by plans.
And what's the duty to cooperate? And then people obviously, you talk about strategic planning and have we moved away from that? There are some advocates.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
It's a disaster is what it's about. It's a total disaster. And you know, I think that's funny. On either side of the debate, I think the duty to cooperate is the one thing that nobody seeks to defend who's been working in this area for the last decade or so. So the duty to cooperate was introduced by the Localism Act 2011, which is the second time I've referred to that piece of legislation. It's the legislation from which all, you know, terrible things have flowed in the last sort of 10 years or so. What was it about? It was about filling the shoes left by abolished regional plans. So we used to have to deal with impacts and needs across local authority boundaries. We'd have regional plans. That was all abolished by the Localism Act. So what do we replace it with? A duty for individual authorities to cooperate with one another. What does it actually require them to do? It requires them to engage constructively. I mean, what does any of this mean? Not very much, it turns out. Engage constructively with one another on an ongoing basis in relation to the sustainable development or use of land. It might mean agreements on joined up approaches. They might decide to enter into joint DPDs or development plan documents. Whatever. It's a legal duty. It's a legal duty to do it. And that is important, actually, because when you look over the last sort of 12 months or so, there's been a whole raft of local plans which have failed at the first furlong. They haven't even got off the ground because of their failure of the duty to cooperate, because it's a legal test that you can pass or fail. It's not something that the inspector can use their judgment to say, oh, well, you know, it's okay, or well, in the round, I think it's probably going to be a sound plan anyway. It's a legal test. And if you fail it, it's back to square one. So that's why it's been such a catastrophe. But really, the problem is with it is it's only a duty to engage with other authorities. It's not a duty to agree anything. Which means even when authorities really do try and talk to one another, it doesn't actually mean that you're going to get, you know, effective cross-boundary planning. You could totally accord with the duty to cooperate with your neighbours and you could achieve precisely zilcho when it comes to cross-boundary strategies. It can't really be policed in the courts. And, you know, the really substantive early engagement that could actually be of value in terms of engagement between neighbouring local authorities, it takes time, it takes resources, and it takes mutual political will. And in the authority areas that we're talking about, you know, about who's going to take the housing needs in these sensitive greenbelt areas, that political will can be very hard to come by.
So how does that interact with setting the local plans where there is a lack of the political will, or, you know, those who get allocated are low in need as a result of some housing delivery test, you know, just drop a shoulder on it because all of a sudden they've got a little bit less to deliver and they don't necessarily want to cooperate as much as you just alluded to. So how does the duty cooperate interact with that? And what's the test?
I mean, there are two sort of possibilities, really. There are authorities who do just about enough to get by. And so you'll get a plan, but it's not really a plan that's doing as much as it should to meet needs, because really the authority should be meeting, yes, its own needs, but also should be taking on the needs of its neighbours. Or more in a more sort of high profile way, see St Albans, see Sevenoaks, see Tunbridge and Malling in Kent. There are lots of authorities whose plans have gone up in smoke because of a failure to accord with this duty to cooperate. I've seen lots of authorities literally in the last, you know, 12 months. So we don't need to look very far for examples of this happening. So the answer is that, you know, the problem with the duty to cooperate is, number one, it just doesn't work. And number two, actually, it ends that you end up with fewer plans, not more plans. So it's, as I say, it is not at all conducive to the setting of local plans.
There was a question in the consultation for the planning white paper about this, about what should replace it. I spent a long time trying to think over that, because in theory there's nothing at all wrong with the idea that housing need can be shared among local authorities that might especially be ones that are linked by transport or other stuff like that.
And I
feel like where I came out was, what if there's some transitional period before we move into some big new planning regime where all of the kind of numbers local authorities need to hit are handed down. And then they can essentially use this transition period to agree amongst themselves who takes what. But if they can't, then you just default to what the government said in the first instance.
I think that my take is that one way or another, whether we call it, you know, strategic planning or what, there's going to need to be some level of cross local planning authority boundary, a tier of plan making or evidence gathering. And there's been some good work that's been done on this by Catriona Riddell, who's been working with the County Councils Network, and also by the RTPI. And they're calling them different things, but they're coming up with this idea of bodies that sit on top of groups of local authorities that gather evidence on needs and that set out, you know, because it's not just about housing, it's about infrastructure. It's about all of the things that go along with supporting new communities and growth and economic growth and development. And trying to decide where those things go is a strategic question. It's not just about shuffling around, you know, housing units on a board. So I think that whatever we do next, we need to, and the government needs to, you know, fill the hole that will be left by the duty to cooperate when it goes, with some kind of strategic thinking about planning across local authority boundaries. The government seems open to that idea, because what it says in the white paper of August of last year, Planning for the Future, it says, we want to get rid of the duty to cooperate, but we don't know what we want to do instead. We you know, we're open to discussion on that. So discussion there has been, and it's still ongoing. It's a really critical issue, this, though, because when we're thinking about how we meet needs in particular for housing, there's this sort of square peg into a round hole problem that we've got for ourselves now. The government revised its method at the back end of last year for determining how many houses each local authority area should need to be targeting. And as you guys will know, and as lots of our listeners may well know as well, after coming under some political pressure from the Tory backbenchers in respect of what was deemed the mutant algorithm for working out how many homes go where, the government did a bit of a U-turn and decided in the end to stick pretty much with the status quo. But that the status quo doesn't work, because it doesn't get you up to 300,000 homes. So what they did in order to plug the sort of shortfall was to say, okay, we will increase delivery within urban areas, within the largest towns and cities, in order to meet the shortfall that we've identified. So far, so good, you might think. Isn't that exactly what we should be doing? Shouldn't we be encouraging, you know, new homes in our most sustainable settlements? Well, the few problems with it are, number one is that it's completely unrealistic. That's the first problem. It's completely unrealistic. I mean, the London target is boosted to over 93,000 homes a year, which won't kick in for a few years because of the new London plan target. But London's recent delivery has been under 40,000 homes a year. So that's your first problem. And, you know, and it's the same when you look elsewhere. You know, in Brighton Hove, they delivered 540 homes last year, which was a good year for them. Their new target under the standard method, 1,200 plus. Bristol delivered...
Surely that's in the current planning system. I mean, we could imagine a world where if some of the white paper proposals are made into law and there's a lot less discretion involved, surely we could reach much higher numbers.
If wishing would make it, maybe. The thing is that there's two things to say about that. The point about it, the focus on these urban areas is that most of them are constrained one way or another, either by the Green Belt or by an equivalent sort of high-end environmental designation. London, which is really, you know, the major contributor to meeting the shortfall under the revised standard method, is obviously surrounded by the Metropolitan Green Belt. And so you've got the problem that you've got is that the government's decided to try and really focus growth within the urban areas, which will require revisions of and flexibility around its approach to the Green Belt, because there's no other way to reach those numbers. But it's not proposing or bringing forward any strategic mechanism to review Green Belt boundaries properly. So you're stuck. They're piling the numbers into the cities. They're giving the shires and the, you know, our green and pleasant land they're letting them off by not imposing higher housing targets on those parts of the country. But it doesn't work if London can't deliver the numbers, because in part London's surrounded by the Metropolitan Greenbelt, and the government takes a very, very stringent approach to developing in those areas. That's the first thing to say. And the other thing to say about your, mightn't the white paper sort it out question is possibly, but there's an enormous hole at the heart of the white paper that's really important, because the white paper focuses on process, it focuses on paring back and, paring down the local plan process, making them shorter, making them quicker, more digital, imposing housing numbers from above. Now, that all sounds perfectly sensible, but it doesn't tell you how. It doesn't even give you any hint as to how, literally how, the civil servants at Marsham Street who work for the ministry are going to go about that, the incredibly controversial and difficult process of imposing policy on housing targets. Really important distinction, not just objectively assessed need targets, but policy on targets that have already taken account of things like, Greenbelt, AOMB, all of that stuff. They're making all the big decisions centrally and handing those down on tablets of stone to individual local planning authorities. How's that going to work? I mean, yeah, it would really speed things up if it did, but how on earth is that going to work? And, just to sort of test that, think about what happened last year with that mutant algorithm discussion that I just sort of alluded to. That was front page news, particularly in the Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail. That was big, big stuff in the Tory shires. And the government U-turned. If you think that was bad, if you think that was controversial, difficult, try policy on numbers where the central government has decided how much your patch of Greenbelt is worth.
I'd argue part of the reason why that was so controversial is because we are this kind of policy on, what you're calling policy on approach, is coming in, and some of the assumption is, well, what if these numbers are ours forever? So I wouldn't say it's necessarily going to be a much greater problem than that one. And that's one example of how central government has indeed set targets which are authorities.
They back down. I mean, their targets, even in the face of non-binding policy off targets, right? So the reason this is important is because the government's standard method does not fix targets that local authorities have to meet. The local authorities can depart from those targets for any number of reasons by applying policies of, environmental constraint or whatever it might be. So even for policy off non-binding targets, the government faced such a backlash from its backbenchers that it had no option, so Robert Jenrick felt, but to literally say, right, well, all of the, all the extra housing, don't worry, Cotswolds, don't worry, East Anglia, it's all going in, the cities. And that's what happened. It's a U-turn. They did not follow through on the perfectly sensible suggestion in their proposal to revise the standard method. Now, I'm not a politician, thank goodness. I mean, this is genuinely all above my pay grade, but all I can do is sort of read the runes. My expectation is that however much of a challenge it was to try and take on local and national politicians in terms of trying to revise the standard method last time, however great of a challenge that was, it's going to be a lot harder next time when you've got policy on binding housing targets that you have to meet. So what I think is that there's going to have to be some sort of process whereby those numbers are interrogated, a challenged, or looked into, maybe, an oral process. There might be some sort of hearings or that kind of thing where they're debated, written process whereby objectors or developers or whoever can put in their reps as to how many homes, Harrow needs, or how many homes, whatever. But whatever that process looks like, the government has not told us yet. We've got literally no idea. So I'm very much in favour of a more strategic approach to housing numbers being taken that transcends local authority boundaries. I've yet to see evidence that the government's going to be able to follow through on delivering it.
From what you said, in my mind, it should be really simple for local authorities to set a target. They need to set a target to increase their net additional housing stock more than incomes are going to grow, and our target's 2%. And, just taking it back to what you were saying there about some of the issues that have been contentious that perhaps, shouldn't have been, and what's coming is probably going to be even more contentious. You touched on Greenbelt and AONB, and I suppose this is kind of like the holy grail of the political quagmire around what's stopping us from actually delivering enough homes. I mean, can you just tell, for everyone's benefit, what is the Greenbelt? How does it differ from SSSI? And then what examples can you give where, you know, the Greenbelt has prevented legitimate reasons to develop? I mean, we've touched on why it, you know, impacts on local plans, but perhaps there's more specific cases you can touch on as well.
I mean, the trouble, I think, it sounds a silly thing to say, but I genuinely think the trouble starts with the name, because it's not green and it's definitely not all a belt. You know, and if they'd called it something like urban containment zones or something, you know, that actually described what the function of the policy is, then I think it would honestly take a lot of heat out of the debate, because how can anyone be against the green belt, if you put it like that? You know, it sounds like it's referring somehow to a general kind of generic countryside policy. And the problem is that the folks over at CPRE, who are obviously, you know, right at the heart of having promoted the Greenbelt from its very inception, they know that, and they use that to their advantage by promoting themselves as the countryside charity. And when they refer to the justifications for the Greenbelt, they conflate it with all kinds of other lovely things, you know, all sorts of other great things to do with the countryside. And they make it seem as if, well, to be for the Greenbelt is to be for the countryside, which means to be against the Greenbelt is to be against the countryside.
And the media gets in on this so much too. Often when you see articles about the Greenbelt in different news sources, they show pictures of this amazing green countryside. And when you dig deep, it's actually often not Greenbelt land. It's often down the road.
So, I mean, it's so true. I mean, the starting point is just to be clear about what we're talking about and what do we value about the Greenbelt? What's it actually for? The bits that are worth keeping, why are they worth keeping? Is it just because they're pretty? No, that's the starting point. So we've got, you mentioned triple SIs, which is one thing. They're areas of special interest due to their ecology, their flora, fauna, geological, physiographical features, and they're designated under a piece of legislation, the Wildlife and Countryside Act, for ecology reasons, triple SIs. Then you've got AONBs. AONBs, they're originally created under the same legislation that created national parks in this country in 1949. But now they're designated now under the Countryside and Rights of Way Act 2000.
Areas of outstanding natural beauty, right?
Areas of outstanding natural beauty. Absolutely. Sorry about the jargon. And those are areas outside national parks. So you start with national parks that are obviously designated for their sort of extreme physical beauty. Outside those national parks, you've got areas which are of such outstanding natural beauty that naturally think they need designating for the purpose of conserving and enhancing the natural beauty of the area. Okay, fine. So that's what AONBs are about. They're about physical beauty. What's the Greenbelt about? It's not about landscape or visual beauty. It's not an AONB. It's not about, you know, ecology or flora or fauna. It's not a triple SI. So what is it about? It's about sprawl. It's about containing urban sprawl. Now, sprawl is one of those words that I don't like, because it's a bit of a pejorative word. One person's sprawl is another person's house. But that's the word that the government minister used in 1955 when he introduced the first Greenbelt circular. He said, what we need to do, and it's after the Second World War, you've got bombed out cores of our major cities. And that the real risk that the government was seeking to alleviate was that of, you know, suburbanisation, endless suburban sprawl. And it was the idea of drawing a green girdle around our cities. Now, you know, it has a place. The idea of you know, preventing sprawl, quote unquote, has a place as one amongst a whole suite of strategic tools, strategic spatial planning tools to try and create sensible spatial solutions to meeting our needs. Don't get me wrong. This is the thing. As soon as you even question what the Greenbelt is about, the you get characterized as someone who would do away with the Greenbelt altogether. And that's not my position. But what my position definitely is that we should have this discussion from a starting point of actually understanding what it's for. you know, and what we value about it and what we don't, so that we can have a little bit more of a sort of grown up, sensible and kind of politics free discussion about the pros and cons of using it as a spatial tool. Because, of course, there are cons that come along with the sort of quasi-religious approach that planners take in this country to the Green Belt.
Can you tell us about the, I think there was a care home that I think was on half a car park. And, you know, we've obviously got a dire care need here. Is it, you know, can you elaborate on some of those cases that you might have worked?
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of day to day, it's the one policy in my line of work advising those who would bring forward development of all kinds, that where black is white and white is black, you know, where up is down and all the rest of it, where perfectly sensible, sustainable and reasonable kind of development solutions, you're telling clients not in a month of Sundays, no way. And the first big Green Belt sort of confrontation I had with the realities of what it is to be planning in the Green Belt was really early on in my career. I was promoting an extension to a dementia care home in Essex, in an Essex Green Belt authority, in an area of Essex where the need for more dementia care beds is not in the hundreds, it's in the thousands. It's a serious, serious crisis. Now, first, we've got a national crisis going on in terms of dementia care, so that's the starting point. But actually, it was a local crisis too, because the numbers were so bad that people were being put up in A&E wards, you know, rather than actually being given the specialist care and accommodation that they need. So it was really astonishing. And I said to my client, well, you know, I mean, what we need to do is to, I mean, the first thing, as you said, is that this was a case where all we were doing was extending an existing care home into the car park. So it was the car park of the existing cairn that we were going to extend into with some fantastic, beautifully designed by a specialist architect, you know, because you need to create units that actually suit the characteristics of the people who are going to be living there. It takes really careful bespoke design, and we had a superb design. The car park was obviously had no value whatsoever as a sort of interesting piece of landscape. And actually the Greenbelt boundary, as it happened, went through the car park. It went, you know, the line literally went halfway through the car park. So half the car park was in and half the car park was out. Now, technically, what all of that means is that we were promoting a quote unquote inappropriate piece of development in the Greenbelt for which we needed to show very special circumstances. That's the test in national policy. So I said to my client, well, if we just explain how great the need is for this specialist accommodation, you know, it's and that's not going to be contested by the local planning authority. They'll agree with us. It's a terribly, terribly great need. And if we bring along our architect and we show the planning inspector how cleverly and carefully these units have been designed in order to cater for the day-to-day needs of people with this sort of with this very, very difficult condition. And if we show the inspector that our, you know, ratings from the people who evaluate, from the CQC, from the people who evaluate these dementia care homes, we're getting top marks, and all the people in the other care homes in the area are getting, you know, thumbs down. So we're a top class operator who you should be wanting to encourage. I said, surely then. Well, that'll be enough to get us over the hump on very special circumstances and show that, yeah, we've got some very special circumstances that warrant permitting this development to go forward. And I was wrong. We went to the inquiry. The local authority did not contest any of the evidence on need, on the scale of the need, on the quality of our operation, on the quality of our design. They didn't contest any of it. They said, yeah, it is a terrible need. It's a very acute need. Even then, it was not enough to turn a car park into a dementia care home. And that you know, really struck
me. Radicalized you.
it stayed with me because, it made me think, gosh, that really is, you know, putting your head in the sand when it comes to trying to meet needs in a sensible way. And unfortunately, it was a harbinger of things to come in my professional life, because I do lots and lots of cases in the Green Belt. I mean, literally every day I advise on schemes in the Green Belt. I'm telling clients, I mean, honestly, I have the conversation several times a week when I say, look, this is a scheme which is on the edge of a perfectly sustainable settlement. It's not an interesting or valuable landscape. So it's well screened, well contained. You've got good, you know, footpaths into the center of the town or the village or whatever. You've got good cycle routes in. It's a sustainable place to be. No technical constraints, no heritage problems, no valuable landscapes, no designations. It's a very sensible place to do, say, you know, a housing scheme or whatever it might be. But you will never get consent for this, at least not at the local level, because of the Greenbelt and the way that this government has approached Greenbelt and has sought at times to consciously conflate. So it's not just that people are getting confused by mistake. Sometimes this government actually confuses them on purpose by trying to conflate Greenbelt on the one hand, which is the general countryside on the other. So it's a real challenge. Not the Greenbelt itself, which could be a perfectly sensible policy tool, but the way that the Greenbelt has been, you know, used or misused, used and abused, if you like, and turned into this sort of great totemic, almost religious policy that thou shalt not contravene. That's a big problem. A real challenge for a sustainable growth, I think, in England.
And can you tell us a bit more about what's so special about Burley and Wharfdale? You've done a good blog the other day, and I encourage others to read the Planner Act blog because it is very accessible, but there's a lot of detail. But, you know, it touches on Greenbelt when you can, can't, you know, the hokey cokey it looked like from reading it of whether you could or couldn't build homes on it. I couldn't quite keep up with all the changes.
Yeah, it a lot of people in my industry got very excited so earlier on in March of 2021 because of the Secretary of State, Robert Jenrick, produced an appeal decision which granted planning permission for 500 homes in Burley and Wharfdale, which I noted in the post is the home of ex-Countdown presenter Richard Whiteley, which is a pretty nice fact about Burley and Wharfdale. 500 homes in the Greenbelt, and you think, gasp, what on earth is going on here? You know, that doesn't seem in the least consistent with what the government are telling us about, you know, thou shalt protect the Greenbelt at all costs. So everybody got very excited. Does this mean that, you know, the government's approach to preserving the Greenbelt at all costs is over? Is it now a government that's tearing the Greenbelt up? Is the revolution upon us? And the point is that it's not. The revolution is not yet upon us. It might be in a few years, but it's not here yet. And that's because if you look at sort of under the skin a little bit of what was going on in that very high profile case, it was actually a failure of the planning system that had led to the need to be there in the first place. The local authority, the city of Bradford, if they'd been sort of, you know, keeping to their timetable for producing their local plans, had always intended this site to come forward for housing. And so really the Secretary of State was just acknowledging what should have been obvious. The local authority wasn't even contesting the appeal, which is on a Greenbelt site for 500 houses is, you know, absolutely unbelievable. Very, very unusual. And what I noted in that blog post was that this is actually a mini trend. It's a trendette, if you like. There are these very high profile Secretary of State decisions. Last year, there was one in Oxford Brookes and there was another one in Stockport, where the Secretary of State saying, yeah, thumbs up to hundreds of houses in the Greenbelt. And on the face of it, you think, gosh, what on earth's going on there? That seems pretty radical. But actually, when you read them, when you get into the facts of each of them, each time really, it's a site that's been allocated or has been proposed for allocation. Maybe it's a site with substantial, you know, buildings on it already that are being replaced. Or in the case of the Stockport decision last year, in addition to all of that, there was a state-of-the-art special needs school that was being proposed. And, you know, so there are these very unusual circumstances where the Secretary of State decides to grant permission for substantial amounts of housing on Greenbelt land. But normally what you need in order to get there is you need a council with a very substantial housing shortage. Well, there's quite a few of those around, so that's a decent start. But you also need a site that has been at some point in the, down the line proposed for release from the Greenbelt and for allocation for housing by the authority, even if it's not got there yet. That proposal's always been there in the background, because of the site either substantially or completely failing to contribute to the purposes of the Greenbelt. So that's what's special about Burley and Wharfedale. But I think, you know, it doesn't really represent the sort of sea change in approach to Greenbelt sites that I think perhaps a lot of my clients were rather hoping that it did.
Amazing. I mean, I don't know, we're sort of running short of time, but it would be good to just sort of end on hearing about, well, you know, if you were king for a day, what would a better planning system look like? And, you know, are the planning white papers moving in the right direction? And, you know, how do we make those processes and local plan processes work? Because it seems like it's all a bit of a mess.
It is a bit of a mess. I would urge everyone listening to read the article that was written by Steve Quatermain, the ex-chief planner, and Lord Matthew Taylor in the Independent. A really sensible and smart take on the white paper, with which I completely agree. And their big point is that the trouble with the white paper, and there's a lot of good stuff in the white paper, don't get me wrong, a lot of stuff about digitising the planning system, streamlining the length and the content of local plans, making it more digital, standardising more policies at the national level. I'm behind all sorts of the proposals in the white paper. But the trouble with it is that it buries a lot of uncontroversial improvements that could all be done pretty quick and without the need for legislation, with some whopping great systemic reforms that will take a long time, cost hundreds of millions of pounds, and may not work. So I actually think, for what it's worth, I think that there's an awful lot that we could do and should do right now without the need for, you know, legislation that's going to take years to get through. A lot of the big changes that would really make a difference day to day could be solved, I think, with amendments to national policy rather than law. And also by, I know this sounds a bit boring, but by resourcing planning departments better, because, you know, so much of it comes down to local government being on its knees, under-resourced, with officers who don't have the experience, don't have the support, don't have the time to deal with applications properly. That's a big, big problem too. But, you know, I do find it a bit ironic because, you know, a lot of what the white paper is about is trying to deal with delay. The delay in the planning process, how long it takes, you know, X years for a housing scheme to get from application to unit sprouting out of the ground and all that sort of stuff. When I did a planning inquiry for a scheme in Kent in October of 2019, October 2019, it took a month. We had all the cross-examination of expert witnesses, all back and forth. This was on a site which had been allocated years before in a local plan. We're applying for housing on a site which the local authority had allocated in its own local plan and then refused us planning permission against officers' advice. Here we were fighting it out at a planning inquiry. In 2019, the Secretary of State has recovered that appeal. And we've still not heard what the answer is, even though the inspector produced the inspector's report, you know, very shortly after the appeal at the back end of 2019, early 2020. So it's a little rich sometimes to hear central government talk about, you know, speeding up the planning system when you think, well, you know, just give us some decisions a bit sooner, please. You know, give us our resource planning inspectorate so that it doesn't take a year, you know, from start to finish sometimes to go through an inquiry process on an appeal. There's a lot that central government could do internally, just, you know, boring stuff, boring procedural stuff about speeding up timetables to get to decisions that could make a really big difference. None of that stuff needs, you know, fancy new legislation. It just needs a bit of resourcing.
Fascinating. I don't know, have you got any thoughts, Ruben, on whether, to what extent tinkering around the edges or a bit of money is going to make that much of a difference?
More better timetabling, better resourcing clearly will make a difference, but I don't want to find myself in the year 3000 still with the Town and Country Planning Act as the main way we're deciding on new homes. I feel like a step change is absolutely needed. The white paper is open to a lot of interpretation. And the way I would like to interpret it, I think it will make a huge positive difference. Whether that's the same as government intended and whether it will actually arrive there when it eventually happens is another question.
Great. Well, look, I'll tell you what, I think we'll probably have to wrap it up there. But Zach, that's been incredibly fascinating. And, you know, we are, you know, big, big fans of yours at Priced Out. And, you know, we encourage all of the listeners to read the Planner Acts and follow Zach Simons, as he writes quite often on these issues. So thanks a lot, Zach, for coming today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, guys. Really nice to talk to you, and all the best.
Our next episode will be with Councillor Shama Tatler as we discuss issues around democracy in our planning system. Thanks again to Zach and our listeners. Don't forget to use the hashtag PriceThatPodcast. Cheers.